It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. And this is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here on this sort of interesting but pleasant Saturday morning. We had a little rain. Well, actually, we had a little bit more than a little rain.
Yeah.
At least at our house. It was definitely really coming down last night. But it's okay. We need it. We're not not going into a wildfire season if this keeps up. That suits me just fine. And anyway, it's been another interesting week, and sometimes that's good news and sometimes it's bad news. This week it's pretty much good news. So anyway, before we get into it all, I'd like to welcome all the regulars back and thank you, because you keep tuning in, we keep showing up. That's the way it works. And we will come in and do what we're doing right now, talking about whatever we want to talk about, unless you or any of the new people, who I would also like to stick around for an hour, if anybody wants to talk about something different than what you're hearing, just pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255, and we will put you on. If you would like to contact us for a not on the air question or anything, just you can go to our website, vanweefinancial.com, and there is a way to email us at info@vanweefinancial.com. And if you want to do it during the show, Adam will sometimes catch that time and we might be able to answer something there. Otherwise, if anyone asks us a question that we either don't know or doesn't come in time, we will always get back to you the next week and get it answered. And always remember, there are no easy questions. There are no simple questions. Nothing is too easy. If there's something you don't know, there are other people who don't know the same thing. So never fear. And as I remind people, your job is to make the host look good. So the easier the question, the better we look. Take it from there. It's on your shoulders. All right, this week we all made some money, not without the typical volatility we've seen lately, some ups and some downs, and of course with all the different types of news that was out there, for all of that, I thought it was relatively tame.
Well, it was basically a Fed week.
Yeah, that was much more important than the convention week.
Fed Chair Powell spoke at Jackson Hole, I think is where they are, wherever the heck they are. And in typical fashion, it was, you know, one big up day, one big down day, and you never know what's going to happen. But if you listen to the show, you know that we're not a big fan of the Fed, and we're not a big fan of Fed chairs in general. But we have been pretty complimentary of Powell, and I'm going to continue that streak because he spoke very plainly in his public remarks and said, we're going to, I mean, he didn't say this, but he said it, we're going to lower rates in September. So we now know, I think with 100% certainty, that they are going to go down, I think, by a quarter point.
Yeah.
You could make a case for a half point, but those types of reductions tend to happen when things are really bad. So there has, so you're seeing the market crash, or you're seeing, I don't know, some kind of event happen. 9/11, I think they did at least that, if not more. Just things like that. And to start off with that, I don't think would set up a very good tone going into this.
Agree.
So I really think a quarter point.
The market
point,
thinks, I think they're pricing like 75% chance.
And but
I
the disagree. Other 25% is at a half point. I thought it was 75%.
Oh, I thought it was the other way around.
Point.
Yeah.
And,
those odds I could live with. If he does a half, I want to know why.
I don't see a need for it. We're not in a dire emergency situation. In fact, it's really the opposite of that. We're in a situation where you're still seeing conflicting data, which I'll get to in a minute.
That's a usual reaction to the notorious too little too late that so many Fed chairmen have been behind the eight ball on that. But I think he's stayed fairly current. The one thing I can say for just about certain is that if Powell got replaced, we wouldn't like the new person any better than this one.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, and probably much worse.
Yeah, definitely much worse. I would be willing to bet on it.
Yeah.
So the reasoning behind the Fed's upcoming decision is pretty clear at this point. Inflation has cooled to a point where the risk of disinflation is higher than the risk of resurgent inflation. So the chances of prices starting to go down are probably higher than the chance of prices starting to go up rapidly again. they're still going up between 2 and 3% on most measures of inflation that you look at, but that's a healthy amount of inflation. 9%, not healthy. Negative anything, also not healthy. So cutting rates will help ensure that we don't see disinflation, which is very damaging for the economy.
Or worse yet, deflation. Makes it technically a little different.
Okay. That is one portion. The other portion is that the job market continues to soften, and it's at a point that the Fed is actually worried that further job losses would lead us into recession. And speaking of which, we magically lost 800,000 jobs this week. Where did they go?
Poof.
Yeah, just out of the blue. Lowered the last 10 months or something from like 220,000 to 175,000 job growth on average. Just magically lost 800,000 jobs. I hate when that happens. Unbelievably huge error by the government. Well, not surprising.
If they were trying to exaggerate so Biden could keep his job, I'd say they failed.
Yeah, yeah. I also find the timing odd. Maybe this is when they always do the revisions.
No,
but
it's not.
It's not. I mean, it's really not making a great case for the incumbent party to do this right before 70 something days before an election. Not ideal. Really gives a lot of ammo to the other side.
Well,
so
they, you know, all you need for a lever is a fulcrum, and that was one of them.
Yeah, that's crazy. But it definitely gives Powell more ammo to go in with a rate cut when you see that many jobs disappear overnight.
Yep.
Additionally, the unemployment rate, which is not it's not high by historic standards, but it's the highest it's been in several years. It's at 4.3%, and the trend is definitely up this point. So I think those are the kind of things that the Fed is looking at and saying, yes, we need to probably do something before it gets worse. But then you have to balance that with the fact that consumers are holding up pretty well. We saw that in retail sales numbers last week. Pretty strong numbers. Additionally, household debt is relatively low when you look at it versus income. And people have a lot of equity in their homes. So there's things about the consumer that are looking decent. And then on the other side of that, though, you've got credit card delinquency rates at the highest rate this decade. You've got auto delinquency rates climbing. And then overall loan delinquency rates are also climbing. So they're in a decent spot, but it's not getting better. It's getting worse. So you look at all of this and you see kind of a deteriorating economy. And that is what they're worried about.
Yeah, the bottom line here is that with 19.25% inflation over the last 3.5 months, or 3.5 years, I mean, people's wages, spending money, power, whatever, disposable personal income, the disposable income has dried up and they're still struggling. That's why the credit card overall debt is rising so high. And those are troublesome signs for what's ahead. Yet people are still spending a lot of money, so we'll have to see what the reaction is soon. Talk more about that in just a couple of minutes. Take a short break. Right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And this week we have, as usual, a trivia question, and I'm going to start doing it right now. Brought to you by Paul Lloyd at First Coast Alarm. I had occasion to talk to Paul yesterday, actually, because we have a sensor that needs a battery. And I was reminded what a very nice, well-spoken, and reactive person he is, too. So I think between Paul and Ken, they've made a very satisfactory deal so the company can carry on, as has been expected right along. So it's the good news. Anyway, you can call Paul at 904-636-7888, and you will get somebody. Now, I'm not sure if that's a number I called yesterday. It probably is, but they've got a real lengthy telephone hierarchy. One for Paul, two for Ken. That's it. You know, it's like calling us. You're going to get a familiar voice one way or the other, that's for sure. Anyway, we've been talking for a while now, on and off, about the Federal Trade Commission trying to put a kibosh on almost all of the non-compete agreements in the country. And non-competes have been heavily used by a lot of companies and a lot of people. A lot of people get paid a lot more day to day because they will sign a non-compete for a while if anything else happens. And there are people that are upset that they exist, and there are a lot of people who really enjoy the fact that they exist. So the FTC issued their edict that was going to make them go away in early September, and a federal judge in Dallas just stepped in and put a halt to it for now until it gets a little further. And that's all well and good. Rushing into anything is not a good idea. But I want to know, what percentage of American workers are subject to a non-compete agreement? It's between 0 and 100. Okay. Actually, it's between 1 and 100. So yeah. I helped you out a little bit there.
Yeah, this is one of those issues where I don't think you can take an absolute line on it. Mm-hmm. There's certain fields where it makes a lot of sense, and there's certain fields where they're absolutely abused. So having an outright ban is stupid, as is having a free-for-all. Anyone can use them and put them on an employee when clearly there's no need for it, and it is to the detriment of that employee's future earnings prospects.
The one thing I always insist on, if you're going to have one, it should be disclosed up front before the deal is made.
Absolutely. And also, I think that you have to be at a certain level for. I don't think it should be the rank and file.
No,
like if you're working for a plumbing company, there's no way that you should be able to not allow your employee to go work at another plumbing company. No. It just that's ridiculous. That stifles.
And if you want that, you better overpay the plumber a lot.
Well, you should be able to keep him if you're overpaying him, so you don't need that
exactly.
Anyway.
So why do you need it?
Yeah.
It gets redundant. You're right. But anyway, what percentage of American workers are actually subject to a non-compete? That's the question for today. Lines are open, by the way, 904-222-8255. Okay, back to the market. There was quite a lot of activity this week.
There was. Despite that kind of mixed review on the economy that I just gave, the markets had a good week. The Dow was up 1.3%, and both the S&P and the NASDAQ were up 1.4%.
That was nicely balanced.
All three indexes are now up on the month, the quarter, and the year, which wasn't the case last week after that bout of extreme volatility that we saw. Earnings season has unofficially closed as of last week, but we did see a few more reports trickle in this week. Target was one of those, a company that had lost its way a bit recently. They got a little too woke for people's liking, I think. A lot of backlash on some of their decisions. They had a really bang-up quarter, though, and really bounced back strongly. They beat their earnings per share guidance by 18%. And they also raised their full year guidance, and their stock responded accordingly. It was up about 10% on that day when I looked at it. So good to see them coming back around. I know it's a favorite retailer of a lot of people.
It's a very important company, I believe.
I agree. On the other side of the coin, we had Macy's, which missed on just about every measure in earnings per share, sales, everything. And that kind of sums up the whole economy. You've got two retailers. They're not in the same space, but they overlap in a lot of spaces, and one is bouncing back while the other is going down.
And the perception of the two companies is totally different too, and consumers are getting a lot more down to earth right now, and I can see where a former Macy's shopper might be more interested in Target, and maybe Target's people are a little more interested in Walmart. Everybody's kind of shifting their expectations, or at least their purchases down a little bit, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, the retailers that are picking up the most new customers are places like Dollar General and that type of thing.
Which is weird that they're closing a bunch of stores.
I thought that was odd too.
Dollar General's closing stores and Macy's is closing stores. Now, what's that, a tale of two cities or what?
I guess so. I don't know. Strange. One bad piece of news for the market in the short term is that individual investors have gotten very optimistic again, up over 50% bullish sentiment. You know, we hate that. It's never a good sign when everyone's getting excited about the market.
Right.
That's inevitably when the market turns down again, and then they get pessimistic, and that's when the market rallies. So I would not be surprised if next week was a negative week, or at least in one of the next three is down, or maybe all of the next three. Who knows?
One thing you can definitely say about individual investors is they're quick to change their mind.
Yes.
And they react to the evidence in front of their face.
Yes, but they always look at hindsight.
Always.
So it's when the market runs up, they get very enthusiastic, want to dive in. And then when the market goes down, they get very fearful and want to get all out. Yep. And that's how people go broke.
A backward-looking investor playing around in a forward-looking market is a formula for failure.
Them. Yeah, and that's why we're long-term buy-and-hold investors. Yep. It was also a light week for economic data, but we did see some housing numbers that I thought were interesting. They were actually quite positive for once. Mm-hmm. Existing home sales rose 1.3% month over month, while new home sales rose 10% month over month. Also, according to Redfin, housing inventories dropped 5.4% month over month. We haven't seen inventories drop in a while, while prices rose 1.1%. The only negative in that report was that I could find, at least, was that 19.4% of listings dropped their price during the month. And that's a record number of listings, or not number, but percentage. And the percentage selling above asking is down to like a 2-year low as well. So you can see the overall picture. There is lots more inventory. Sales did pick up a bit. I assume that's because mortgage rates dropped. But there's still a decent amount of inventory, and house prices are still rising, but at a much slower rate than what they were. So,
and interest rates, mortgage rates are falling.
Yep.
They're still, well, historically they're good, but when you have the recency bias of the lower rates, they're still pretty high. But already I'm starting to read a few articles about refinancing going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you've got an 8% mortgage, there were 8 very briefly, but
yeah, if you're 6.5, 8,
yeah, for sure. And that's the average. So you might be able to get down closer to 6 if you have good credit.
Well, and if you wait, we are now in a virtual slam dunk of a couple of decreases this year. And if you're looking at it today, you got to keep an eye on it. And if it's not worth pulling the trigger just yet, it might well be that by January it is.
I think there's a high percentage chance. So you will see mortgage applications go up one way or another, whether it's for home sales or for refis. It's probably coming.
Yeah. So for all of you laid off loan processors, keep the faith. You'll be called back soon.
Maybe.
Yeah. If we're prognosticating correctly.
Yep, that was all I had on the market wrap. I did want to talk about one other thing. I found an article that listed the top nationwide relocation hotspots, and you might be surprised to learn that Jacksonville was one of those. They came in 9th on the list, behind Myrtle Beach, Ocala, Houston, Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina, Charlotte, Raleigh, Phoenix, and Knoxville. And rounding out that list was Asheville. One interesting thing that I found about that top 10 list is that all of those are in the Southeast. Isn't that crazy?
Isn't that incredible?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, California couldn't compete.
No, they were not. New York didn't have any. Illinois, you know, just none of those places made this top 10 list.
Yeah. They're leaving there. Apparently, they don't care to leave there for 2 towns over.
Yeah, well, it did surprise me a little bit not to see Phoenix maybe somewhere at the Salt Lake City, because lots of Californians have been relocating to those places because they are closer.
Right. So. Yeah. I don't know. Probably if you did a list of 40, you'd find all those places on it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I think people are probably looking for a real change of pace and a real change of scenery if they're going to places like that. You know, some of those are, you know, like the Research Triangle area. You're not going down into a laid-back retirement community when you do something like that. And maybe some of these people want the excitement, and others just want to go to Florida and not freeze anymore and all that stuff. And so who knows? I'm not surprised that they're in the Southeast, but I'm a little bit surprised at some of the selections in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a bias of my own, that they're not places I'd want to live.
What's that? The other
places like Kentucky. Yeah, that kind of thing doesn't. That's what I call drive-through country. but that's my old biases. When you live in Wisconsin and you want to make a change and you go to Florida, anything in between is just stuff you have to pass through to get there.
Not good enough, yeah.
Exactly right. But anyway, that's interesting. Well, being in the top 10, you know, this city in the many years that we've been here has really, really grown up.
We've been making a lot more top 10 lists than ever have in history. Jacksonville has really been come up, and it's become more of a destination than it ever has been before.
Yep. All right, we'll be right back and get into some other topics. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we remind everybody that the trivia question is still available. It is, a federal judge recently halted a ban on non-compete clauses for employees, and we don't know what's going to come of it, but hopefully a good discussion with a reasonable outcome that serves everybody would be the right way. We'll keep you posted on that as time goes by, too. But my question is, what percentage of American workers are currently covered by a non-compete agreement? And it's between 1 and 100%. And you don't have to worry about any decimal points. I'm going to make it even easier by telling you it's a whole number. So how about that?
All right.
All right. You want to talk football?
Yeah, let's talk a little football. It's week zero.
The only thing I know about what you're about to talk about was Jaguars won again.
They did. They looked good.
This is getting habit forming.
Yeah, they really looked good last night. All levels, the starters down to the guys who are on the cusp of not making the team. Everyone played really well. It was a great game.
Wonderful.
So congrats on that. But also wanted to talk a little bit about college football, because it is officially week zero of the college football season. We've got some big game. Well, a big game on today. Georgia Tech is facing off against my Seminoles, and it's taking place over in Ireland, which is kind of cool, a little bit different. It's a night game over there, but it'll be on at noon today here, and it was a huge undertaking to get over there, apparently. Lots of planning went into this game. It's big business. I mean, it really is. If you look at the revenues for those two programs last year, in 2023, Florida State's football program generated revenues of $91.5 million, and Georgia Tech was just under that at $65.8 million. So it is nothing, but if it's not big business. And I just read that in order to prepare for this game, the two schools had to combine efforts to get everything shipped over. They ended up packing up 238 crates worth of material that weighed 40,000 pounds that were shipped over on cargo planes last week, 4,000 miles across the ocean. So if you don't think this is big business, it really, really is.
We're not going to pull Afghanistan and leave them all that stuff.
I think the plan is to bring it all home.
You never know these days.
Yeah. And that included everything from practice gear to one of the things that they said they brought were condiments for the players that aren't available in Europe. So,
well, probably a bunch of regulation footballs, too, because theirs are all round.
Yeah, that's true. That would be a big issue.
It would be.
Tough to throw a pass.
Yeah. Bad enough with that pointed thing.
So I thought that was just kind of cool. It was a huge undertaking to get everyone over there, and I'm looking forward to the game today.
Yeah. Very interesting. Ireland. You know that? That low tax rate in Ireland is maybe conducive to all of this stuff.
Perhaps.
We're going to talk more about tax rates and intentions and all that before the day is over, too. I got some just kind of miscellaneous little things that I thought were interesting. We've been talking for, let's just round it off to 2 years, about how difficult it is to gauge this economy, and worse yet, to predict where it's actually going. And Adam alluded to the one fact that just a few minutes ago, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has revised, they've done their annual revision on jobs, because your jobs are an estimate as it goes along through the year. And this estimate was revised downward by 818,000 jobs over a 12-month period, ended in March, I believe it was. Now, that still left their braggable number a little higher. But this is a little bit interesting. There are already 600,000 less people working. This news came out before that revision. There were 600,000 less people working now than at the start of this administration. There also has been a great migration from full-time to part-time jobs. So that is all not very good stuff. And here's some more. Since January 1st of 2023, 5,483 companies have announced mass layoffs. Now, I'm not sure for this purpose where they start at mass. I don't know if it's a percentage of the workforce or a number of people, but under this particular definition, 5,483. Oop, make it 84. Cisco just announced a workforce reduction of 7%. And it's going around. You might get really worried about that, and you might not. And the reason you might not is that typically in a retrenching period like this, when we've come out of a very bad recession, and let's face it, the one we came out of with COVID was the worst thing that any person alive right now can remember. So people were ramping up big time, expecting a really, really serious regeneration of their business. And they largely got that. Well, as things go, when you're competing to get your market share back or trying to grab somebody else's when you're getting into a recovery, many people overshoot. And then they start to see the profit margins wane a little bit. So they start laying off people. It doesn't mean their businesses have turned around and are going south. All it means is they can now downsize, right size, whatever you want to call it, trim up their balance sheet by improving their expenses day to day. And that's what's been going on. And there are a lot of companies that have been doing it. It is not a bad thing. And in fact, from an investor standpoint, I would call it a very good thing.
Yeah. You have to remember, we went through a period of a couple of years there where companies were desperate to find employees and mm-hmm. they could not find anyone. And so they did probably pick up a few people who were maybe not as qualified as what they had hoped or just
well, aren't, you know, cutting just, it. Just look at the educational requirements that were downsized at places.
Yeah, definitely.
It used to say college education required, and now it says if you can tie your shoes by yourself, come on in.
Yeah, well, it did. Not anymore. But
nope.
And the other thing that happens during those periods is companies are reluctant to let go of low performers as well.
Right,
so
exactly.
They keep them on because they can't find people to replace them. And then when you get to a more normal part of the cycle, they shed the people that aren't doing as well.
And another impact of what's been going on lately is for anybody who's in the car market, used or new. And what has happened over the last few years is that new car prices have accelerated much faster than the historical average. And they are now, in fact, $6,000 higher than would be expected by simply applying the old rules to the car business. And that is because even though our inventories are growing on the car lots right now, they're still not in balance for what people want. What people want largely today is a good used car under $30,000. They are unicorns today. Yep. You're just not getting them. So that's keeping the price of used cars up artificially. And, of course, the manufacturers see that, and they play let's make a deal on a new one, and they're now what should be a $43,000 average for new cars is now a $49,000 average. That, too, will be self-correcting a little bit. And you can see it because in the last year, used cars are down about 10.9%.
The other way you can see that is you can't get on the internet right now without getting a 0% financing offer, and that is essentially
at today's mortgage rates of 6-something, you get a 0%
right.
offer.
But that's essentially just a price reduction because they're yeah. going to do the financing for you, and
exactly.
they're not going to collect that 6% interest or 8% interest, and so it's a way to reduce prices without reducing prices.
Yeah, and you always want to go shopping and tell them, well, I read about the great financing deal. So you lead them into the deal with them believing they're going to finance it. Then you pull out your checkbook and write a check for it. You just shaved a couple grand off their profits. Yeah.
And another thing that got so crazy in the last couple of years is that cars were being sold at or above MSRP. That's just that was never a thing in a normal car market. They put that MSRP as a starting point, knowing they're going to get less.
The same thing happened in the housing market during the COVID thing where you had a list price, and by the end of one day, you had five offers all above the list price. It was a question by how much. So those days are gone, too. In fact, I think I read 20% of company or of listings now are actually being reduced. Their asking prices have been reduced. So, it's funny, isn't it? What we've just been describing is called the free market.
Yeah, and imagine that. It works.
And yet there are certain politicians who don't seem to believe in the free market. Which we'll talk about after the next break. Yeah. But no. Anyway, while I was on the car thing, thinking about it, my crack research department sent me a little article. It was a Clark Howard piece about cars that are going to last, the most probability of lasting a long time. Mm-hmm. And by lasting a long time, in today's world, he defines that as over 250,000 miles. And I was thinking about growing up and what we used to call a lot of miles. I know a lot of people out there listening are my age, and you'll know this term, but I wonder how many of the young kids were. Remember turning over the odometer?
I mean, I've heard the term.
It was a manual rolling odometer.
Yeah.
It only had five digits in it.
Okay.
So when you rolled it over, it meant you got to 100,000 miles, and it turned up zeros. Well, along with the digital devices that do your mileage now, you also have cars that are being built to a whole different standard, where 250,000 miles now is not an unreasonable expectation. You know, you change brakes and oil and some of the routine things, but they're manufactured to the point where that is not at all unrealistic. So when we come back, I will give you the list of the top 10 who are the most likely to go through, to reach 250,000 miles. And I want anybody to listen to this and see if you can find a pattern in what I'm about to tell you. So don't go anywhere. I won't spill the beans because I don't have time yet. We'll talk to you after a quick break where we pay some bills. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And the trivia question is still out there. How many Americans, what percentage of American workers are covered by a non-compete agreement as we speak today? And you can answer that by picking up the phone, dialing 904-222-8255. All right, we've been talking about cars and longevity. Having been involved in manufacturing for a long time, back in my much younger days, it was the time when people were approaching us, the manufacturers, potential customers, and existing customers, approaching us about implementing kind of quality controls that are used today, statistical process controls. And I, as an old-fashioned type, was resisting it, saying that we did very simple manufacturing. You hit this thing real hard and change its shape. That's what stamping is. But I said, go take it to the intricate manufacturers who are turning the parts and making all kinds of really important mechanical parts. And as it turns out, I was right about that, but I was wrong about us. It applies to everybody. And now, actually, Kia, I think, was the first car to come out totally statistically produced. And they ran for a long time. But the Japanese people started the whole process, but it was started by an American, and a lot of you will probably remember this, Dr. Edwards Deming, after the war, came over to our manufacturers and told them that he could improve the manufacturing process with the statistical process control, and they weren't interested. So he took it to Japan, and they were. And the first thing he taught them was that we were making very good machine tools. Japan was making machine tools, but they were not very good. So he applied it first, not to their assembly line, but to their manufacturing techniques, excuse me, and their machine tools got fabulous. And they were selling those to America for about half price, and they were excellent. And I will admit to anyone that I bought a couple of those pieces back in the 70s for our tool room because they were half price and they worked. Well, anyway, this has bled down now to the lowest levels and the highest levels of the manufacturing process. Excuse me, please. And things are working better and lasting longer. So let's see if you can see a pattern in here. The top five cars that are likely to last 250, Tundra, Sequoia, 4Runner, Tacoma, and Hybrid.
Well, I think we've got a pattern? Caller coming in, too. Okay. So,
yes, I see.
Wait, hold on 1 second, though.
Okay. Anyway, those and position number eight is called an Avalon. Toyota takes six out of the top 10. Chevy has one. No, Chevy has two. Lexus has one. Honda has one. Very interesting. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Steve and Adam.
How are you?
Hanging in there. First and foremost, I want to thank you very much. I called you earlier this week. And I spoke about my girlfriend wanting to give some money to her grandkids, and you led me on the right path. You gave me some very good suggestions, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, I appreciate it. I had a really good time talking. I feel like we've known each other for a long time because we talk to you so frequently on the radio. But you know, when you really have the door wide open, as you did, here's the goal I want to accomplish. How can I do it? And we get a lot of people that call in and say, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? But that's usually not an easy way to get into a good discussion. You said, I want to accomplish this goal. What are the various ways we can do it? And I really enjoyed the talk, and I hope it all works out well for you. So there's a lot of considerations in that. Anyway, well, I was happy to share some time with you, and happier yet that you were willing to share some time with me. So
I appreciate it. Regarding your issue about the non-compete agreements,
mm-hmm.
I remember watching something on one of the business channels back in April. Lisa Kahn from the Federal Trade Commission,
mm-hmm.
she proposed a rule to ban non-compete agreements,
yep.
and I'm wondering, did that ever go into effect, or is that
yeah.
being...
Yeah, it did. That's what we were talking about.
Yep.
It actually did take effect, and then a federal judge stepped in and mm-hmm. issued an injunction against it, saying that it was potentially not legal
yep.
to do that. So now it's going to work its way through the courts, and we'll find out. But as of today, they are legal. As of last week, they weren't legal,
right.
and so we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It was
Very
done in a manner that didn't allow much public input to it. That's one of the problems with it.
Yeah, I remember yeah. that she, or at least the FTC under her, were trying to say that approximately 8,500 more startups would probably be established if they could get rid of the non-compete rule.
Yeah, and I would say to her a simple thing, prove it.
I could see where that number would be potentially real. I mean, if you're looking at, you've got all these employees at a startup and one of them thinks they can do it better, but they've signed a non-compete and they can't go off and start their own, I can make that argument.
There might be something to it. My basic argument is we need a full discussion on this thing. Rather than having the heavy thumb of government come down on something like that and just ban them.
Yeah, I agree.
That is not the way complex and wide-ranging laws should be implemented.
No good decision is made like that. It's no. got to be. It's got to look at the different types of situations in which they're used.
Yeah, it was kind of the same thing as when they were trying to make everybody a W-2 employee instead of a 1099.
Right.
And they tried to just blanket implement that, and they got caught on that one, too.
And that, yeah, and I think both of these things are equivalent because they would be hugely unpopular decisions with mm-hmm. certain parties. Now, certain other parties would really like them, but why are you just going one way? I mean, right. Look at the nuances.
Yep.
Oh, well, very interesting. I was just curious to know if the rule took effect. I didn't know about the injunction, so I guess it's all still pending.
Yeah. Yeah. TBD. Yeah,
I don't know if you heard the trivia question, but my question was, what percentage of American workers are currently covered by one?
Well, again, according to listening to that conversation at the time, I think it's nearly one. I think 30 million Americans, nearly like one in five, so I'll say 18%.
You're a little low, but you did say one in five, and the answer is 20%. So yeah. I'm kind of inclined to say you're a little low, but we don't have time to take anybody else in there anyway.
But that's a good guess. I would have guessed much less than that, actually. I didn't realize it was that high.
You helped us make our point. We appreciate it. That's, you know, when you're talking about something that's that indigenous to the entire workforce of America, you can't just pull the rug out from under something like that. It's crazy talk.
That is a lot of people that are affected.
Exactly.
A lot of employers and a lot of employees that are affected by this decision.
Yep, I agree. Anyway, okay. I appreciate your call, and if you ever want to follow up on any of that on air or off, you know how to find me.
Appreciate it. Have a good weekend, gentlemen.
Same to you.
Too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
20% of people. That's a lot of people.
That's a ton of people. I really did not realize it was that high.
Yeah. And I'm not sure why. I don't have any breakdowns about that. But
that's part of the problem, too, though. I think I suspect with the number being that high that there's a lot of companies that are just using it for every rank and file employee that they have. It's just a standard part of the paperwork when you accept a job. And that's wrong. That should not be the case. I don't like that one bit. Yep. I don't think that it should be applied equally across all levels of management and other parts of the company. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm going to insert a piece of good news between topic A and topic B here for a minute. There is a new bill that's been introduced in Congress by Eric Burleson, who is a Republican from MO's Missouri, Montana.
I always get those confused.
Yeah, MS yeah. Missouri. No, that's Mississippi.
Yeah.
And he's from Mo.
I think MT is Montana.
Yeah, I think it's Missouri. Actually, a lot of good ideas come out of there. He would like to make all long-term care premiums tax deductible to everybody.
I like that.
I think that is one of the most brilliant things I've ever heard.
That would be one of the few things that could potentially push you above that large standard deduction, too.
Yep.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
I really, really like that. If you have the right business setup and the way you tax yourself and the way your own business taxes you, you can get it reimbursed. But most people will never see that as a deduction because they don't reach the limit for medical and regular premiums and expenses deduction. They don't get there. This one I really like. And if it happens to get into the final proposals, we'll report on it. But for those people who are in the business of selling long-term care insurance, this would help. But mostly for the people who could really use it and are still young enough to afford it, there is nothing out there today, and there never will be, that is anywhere near as good as long-term care insurance. There are annuity products and there are life insurance products and several other things that call themselves something to do with long-term care insurance, but they're not long-term care insurance. They are simply cash flows where they give you your own money quicker than they would otherwise. The long-term care insurance is very expensive. If you can buy it young and handle it, good. And if you can deduct it no matter what, you're more likely to be able to handle it. So on that happy note, we'll talk much more about stupid taxation next week. Don't miss it. It'll be fun. Thanks for listening. This is the Van Wee Financial.